Hello.
I'm Sasha.
And I'm Ezra.
And welcome to Season 2 of Concerning Climate.
On today's show, we have Dr. Amanda Baugh.
Dr. Amanda Baugh is an Associate Professor of Religious Studies at California State University, Northridge. She specializes in the study of religion and environment in American culture. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
What kind of work do you do?
So I'm a professor of religious studies at California State University, Northridge, which is in the Los Angeles area. And I teach and conduct research on religion and the environment in the contemporary United States. And I focus especially on communities that historically have not been associated with environmentalism. So in my first book, I looked at an interfaith environmental organization in Chicago called Faith in Place, and the ways that that organization was mobilizing diverse religious communities to protect the earth. And in my second book, which I'm writing now, I'm focusing on environmental values of white and Latinx Catholics, especially those in the Los Angeles area. And I'm thinking about the distinct ways that they think about and nature and the environment, the way they think about it and talk to it and relate to it. So as a scholar of religious studies in this broader field now that we're calling the environmental humanities, I get to think really deeply about the categories we use to understand the world, like religion, race, and the environment, and the ways that we sometimes use those categories in ways that unknowingly cause problems and exclude certain communities. And so the point of pointing those things out isn't just to be a big pain, but also to identify hidden assumptions so that we can overcome them and think more equitably and expansively.
What is religious environmentalism?
Good question. So religious environmentalism generally refers to very intentional, concerted efforts of religious groups to support environmental causes. And it's grounded in an idea that protecting the earth is an important part of their religions. So in many cases, religious institutions and religious leaders have offered official declarations saying that the environment is something that religious communities should care about. And religious institutions started making these statements way back, I'd say all the way back into the 80s, and then it got more popular in the 90s. The Presbyterian USA denomination will send out a declaration saying why they care about the environment and why Presbyterians should. The most famous statement like that that came out recently was in 2015 when Pope Francis, the leader of the Catholic Church, wrote an encyclical letter called Laudato Si on care for our coming home. Have you guys heard of that? No, it's kind of like people are like, oh, wow, this is finally religions are talking about the environment. So he issued this in 2015, and it was intended as a wake-up call to help Catholics and really everyone. The Pope addressed the letter to everyone to help them understand how humans are destroying the environment. So that's an example of like a really major statement that has been issued by a religious organization or a religious institution. So we've got these statements, and then we have a lot of activism surrounding it. So since the 1990s or so, there have been religiously based environmental organizations that have been emerging that are intended to encourage religious communities in their embrace of environmentalism. So there are a few prominent national interfaith environmental organizations. One really predominant one is called Interfaith Power and Light, and they have chapters in almost every state. They're based in San Francisco. And there's also one called Green Faith, which is based in New Jersey, but they're a national organization and really international. They work in various parts of the globe now. So those are some major interfaith environmental organizations. And there's also a number of groups that are based in particular traditions. So there's one called Hazon, which is a Jewish organization that promotes environmental sustainability among Jews. There's an organization called Presbyterians for Earth Care, the Catholic Climate Covenant, Green Muslims. So different religious groups have their own organizations dedicated to environmental issues. And what those types of organizations generally do is develop grassroots campaigns to develop environmental programming and awareness at local religious communities. So they might partner with a church or a mosque or a synagogue and help them form green teams, develop campaigns for any energy reduction. A lot of churches like to do fair trade coffee campaigns, or really, I guess after church, people really like to drink their coffee. That's a big issue that people like to talk about, not drinking from a styrofoam cup and throwing that away, but, using reusable cups. So those types of things. Some organize environmental lobby days. So they'll take religious communities to the state capitol, and they'll, talk to their legislators about environmental issues and kind of say, as a person of faith, this is important to me. Many also connect with food and agriculture. So you'll see a lot of religious institutions now that have food gardens at the local congregations, or they might host farmers markets or work directly with farmers to organize CSAs, community supported agriculture, where people buy a share in a farm and then they get a weekly box of produce. So these are all kind of like sustainable agriculture type things. And then something that's related to religious environmentalism is sometimes called nature religion or green religion. And that describes people who reject traditional forms of religion like Judaism or Christianity, but instead they embrace nature-based spiritualities. So that might be used to describe like radical environmentalists or homesteaders or nature enthusiasts who have rejected the traditional religious affiliations they might have been raised with, but they find spiritual meaning in nature. So some scholars have written about the ways, for example, surfing or fly fishing or radical environmentalism, like tree sitters who, you know, sit in trees, maybe live, Julia Butterfly Hill lived in one for 2 years to protect it from being cut down. And so people have analyzed that type of thing as being a nature religion or a green religion, so that nature itself, you know, is kind of the sacred center of their orientations.
Can you tell us some ways in which popular religious groups are affected by climate change?
Yeah, so I would say, I wouldn't really say that particular religious groups are affected by climate change based on their religious affiliations so much as they're affected by their social locations. So social locations certainly can overlap with religious affiliation, but it's not like, you know, Muslims experience climate change in one way and Jews experience it in another way. I know I listened to some of your previous episodes, which are excellent. I've learned a lot. I know you did one on environmental justice, and your guest talked about how communities who are poor and not white are the most likely to suffer from the burdens of climate change. And I absolutely agree. So religion doesn't map onto that in any particular way. The likelihood that a particular community might be affected by climate change is related to their social location much more than their religion. But I would say that different religious groups have developed environmental programming specific to their particular religions. So Rabbi Arthur Waskow and others have written about eco-kashrut, which adds attention to climate concerns, attention to climate concerns to Jewish dietary laws. So for example, you might say, is it eco-kosher to eat vegetables that were grown using dangerous pesticides that are harmful to farm workers and the earth? Some Muslim organizations have developed green Ramadan campaigns that encourage Muslims to embrace eco-friendly habits during Ramadan, which is the holiest month of the year for Muslims. Catholics have organized Laudato Si prayer days and encourage Catholics to bring environmental activism to celebrate the anniversary of the release of that encyclical. And different religious groups might also organize book clubs, Bible studies, or other sacred text reading groups to learn about and reflect on the way their own traditions say something about the environment. So again, it's not that religious affiliation would be related to how people are affected by climate change, but we could talk about the ways people respond to it based on their religious traditions.
What are some ways that religion and race intersect with the environment and environmentalism?
That is a very excellent question and a very complicated one. So I'm going to talk about it in a certain way, and this is one way out of many. But in my work, religion and race intersect with environmentalism, most importantly, in our assumptions about who can be an environmentalist and what can count as environmentalism. So namely, white people, and especially white people from politically progressive, relatively affluent communities, can easily identify as environmentalists. Whereas people, you know, the idea of environmentalism might be tougher, a tougher sell for people who aren't white. So I like to tell this story about an experience I had at CSUN, where I teach, Cal State Northridge. And CSUN is a Hispanic serving institute, and we serve a ton of students who are first generation college students. So they're first in their families to go to college. They come from immigrant backgrounds. And they generally don't identify as environmentalist. And so one time I was giving a guest lecture in a class that was a colleague's class. And I started talking about my work, and I said, hold on, before we start, who here, raise your hand if you identify as an environmentalist. And there were about 40 students in the room. And about three of them appeared to be white. And when I asked them to raise their hands if you identify as environmentalist, it was those three students who appeared to be white who raised their hands. And the rest of the students said no. But because I've been teaching there for a number of years and had lots of conversations with our students, I knew that there are many students in the room that had environmental values, that did very eco-friendly things, but they just don't think of their things as environmentalist. And I've learned through my teaching, often my students have way lower carbon footprints than I do, but they think that I'm the ideal environmentalist because I look and come from the background of somebody who they associate with environmentalism. I saw similar dynamics for that in the research for my first book, where I was looking at the racial dynamics of this interfaith environmental organization in Chicago. There, I remember I encountered an African-American preacher who said he previously thought environmentalism was a white man's problem. But he changed his mind after Hurricane Katrina when he saw all the suffering that African-Americans experienced in New Orleans. And throughout that research, I met many African-Americans who told me they weren't really environmentalists, even though, you know, they did worm composting, they ate local food from the garden. They even went to environmental lobby day, but they would say like, oh, I'm not really a real environmentalist. And the reason for some of these hesitations to identify with environmentalism is that the environmental movement in the United States, unfortunately, has historically really been connected with affluent white communities. So one of the starting points for the movement that we now know as environmentalism is the conservation and preservation movements that began around the turn of the 20th century. And in those movements, we had relatively well-to-do white Americans, mostly from urban environments, who were starting to get worried that we were destroying nature so quickly we wouldn't have any wilderness left for future generations to enjoy. So they started campaigns to protect wilderness through things like national parks, which are great. I love going to national parks. But in the process of protecting those places for people to enjoy for leisure and recreation, they ended up kicking people off the land who already lived there and depended on that land for their livelihood. So, you know, they made it illegal to hunt and fish and farm in areas where there were families who'd been living for generations off land. And those families were mostly not white families. So that's just one of the many examples of the ways that the environmental movement itself has really been geared toward the interests of white communities and has had negative consequences for Black, Indigenous, and communities of color. So even though there's people from all kinds of communities who care about the earth and want to protect it, it's primarily the concerns of affluent white communities that have gotten the label environmentalism. And it's often white people who most readily identify themselves as environmentalists. That means that communities involved with religious environmentalism also tend to be overwhelmingly white. So that's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity for religious communities to change conversations. Faith in Place, the organization that I looked at in my first book in Chicago, is a national leader that's done really cutting edge work in this area of diversifying environmentalism. And especially thanks to the leadership of this one visionary leader named Veronica Kyle, who's been working there for quite some time now doing outreach. And so she directly addresses the challenge of whiteness and environmentalism. And she works with diverse communities to help them cultivate their own form of environmentalism that's relevant to their own histories and communities. And the way they do that is they start by having conversations in diverse communities and listening to people and learning about the issues that are important to them, and then finding ways to develop programming that meets the needs that that community has and also addresses environmental issues. So for example, during my fieldwork there, they were having conversations among African-American congregations and found out that they were interested mostly in food and employment. So like health, food and health and employment. And they ended up creating these really cool youth job programs where they got funding so they could actually hire teenagers. So it was a paid job in the summer to build gardens in the churches and their parking lots, et cetera. So that it was meeting the need. It was providing employment, providing the youth with a skill, and providing healthy food for the neighborhood and all of that, you know, sustainable food. So it's helping the environment and the community at the same time. So returning to your question, religion and race intersect with the environment and environmentalism in the sense that they can be a barrier to identifying with and engaging in environmental activism, but religious organizations can also create opportunities to challenge those barriers.
So you touched on this a bit before, but what do students find most interesting about your subject?
Mm-hmm. So when I teach my class on religion and ecology, it's a general education class, which means that it meets, you know, just a requirement that students have, and they can meet it in any number of ways. So what I'm saying is that students who come to my class don't necessarily have any interest in religion or the environment. They're just there because it meets a requirement that they need and it works at a convenient time. And in many cases, those students are just really interested to learn that that religion has anything to do with the environment at all. They come to religious studies classes thinking that religion basically means either reading the Bible, they think it's gonna be a class about the Bible, or that religion just happens at church. And they haven't necessarily even encountered the idea that their religious values might also say something about how people should live in relation to the earth. And particularly many of my students are Catholic. And even though they're Catholic and maybe even they go to mass every week, they've never heard of Laudato Si or encyclicals. So they're often excited just to learn about the encyclical and share it with their families and communities. But they also seem to enjoy our conversations about environmental ethics and thinking about how they relate to nature and the environment in their own lives. And these can get really personal conversations. So I'll share details of whatever dilemma I'm having. Maybe, you know, we're having an ant problem at home and I don't want to use the ant traps. What do I do? Right. So I'll share that. And then that kind of opens up opportunities where they'll think about things that they're facing in their own families and how they might deal with it. And in particular, we always do a series of assignments called ecological footprint journals, where students have to take an action basically and then reflect on it. So they might keep a journal of everything that they eat for a few days and then have to trace where all their food came from. Or they might, one year I had them collect all their garbage, carry around their garbage for a day and kind of look at the waste that they're producing. Or taking a carbon footprint quiz online to calculate, you know, their impact on the earth. And these are really effective in helping them identify how they're affecting the planet. But it's also really interesting in the case of many of my students that they realize they already are environmentalists. They already embrace eco-friendly lives without knowing it. So they've never identified with environmentalism. And this was kind of an interesting experience early on when I started at CSUN. We did these carbon footprint journals, and I do it too. We did a carbon footprint quiz, and my carbon footprint is way, 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 way huger than all of theirs. You know, I fly all the time. I live in a 3-bedroom house. You know, we have 2 cars, right? I do all of these things, even though they think of me as the environmentalist. I do all of these things that have a very heavy impact on the earth, whereas they are not environmentalists. They don't think they're environmentalists. And yet, you know, they ride in public transit. They live in an apartment. They're doing a lot of things that have a lot less impact. And I think that's kind of paradigm shifting for students a lot of the time. And it was paradigm shifting for me too, in terms of who can be an environmentalist and kind of where did we even come up with these labels and these categories. And I say, I swear I don't try to convert people to vegetarianism, but people do leave my house, my class as vegetarians. And you know, they'll say they were inspired by something to reduce their meat consumption or take other actions to lessen their impact on the earth. And I'm also amused that I keep saying my house instead of my class, but I think it makes sense because my house is my class now during the pandemic. So there you go.
What are some of the most interesting things you've learned from your research?
Rather than interesting, I'd say the most important things that I've learned have been about checking my own assumptions about what it means to be an environmentalist. So as I mentioned before, American environmentalism historically has been centered around the interests of progressive middle-class white communities. And that's exactly the kind of background that I come from. So white environmentalists like myself often recognize it's important to include diverse coalitions in our work. Yet we often expect everyone to join us and engage in environmentalism the same way that we do. You know, that we want them to think about it in the same way and do it in the same way that we do in the same experiences. So we haven't been very good at listening to and learning from people who don't fit this model of environmentalism that comes from, you know, this white, affluent, progressive history. So based on my research and my teaching, I've learned how different communities and cultures relate to nature and the environment in their own distinct ways. For example, through the work of gardening and agriculture, rather than attending protests or taking vacations at national parks. I think it was my first semester at CSUN, I had brought an environmental historian to campus, and he was talking about, I don't remember the exact topic, but people having recreation and leisure in the outdoors. And one of my students raised her hand and she said, "This reminds me so much of my father, because he's a gardener and he loves nature and he loves being outdoors." And so that was kind of the first time that I was like, oh, right. Right. People who work in nature are also environmentalists too. Right. So her father is not somebody that would go join the Sierra Club or Green Faith or Hazon or anything like that. And yet he is, you know, he gets his very livelihood from nature, going around and taking care of people's yards. And she said he's exactly like all the people that that environmental historian had talked about. And so that was paradigm shifting for me. I think the most important thing I've learned through my research is to see these various orientations as important forms of environmentalism and acknowledge that expertise comes from different forms of knowledge. Sometimes it feels like in the study of religion and environment, sometimes we're focusing too much on learning why people are not good environmentalists. So people are really obsessed with white evangelicals who are climate change deniers. And it's like the conversations often revolve around trying to understand why they're so bad for the environment so that we can then make them good, so we can learn how to fix them and fix the problems. But what I think, what I've been learning, and I think is something really important, is that we white environmentalists don't have all the answers, and we should be open to learning from and being changed through these diverse perspectives.
If you had one piece of advice and or information that you could give to us and everyone listening, what would it be?
I think to keep on doing what you guys are doing, to engage in these conversations and gather knowledge and learn, but also being expansive in your understanding of who the experts are. So the experts aren't only people like me who have a PhD, but people also who have expert knowledge that comes from their experiences in life along paths that might not include extensive formal schooling. There's a concept that I've observed both in my students and my research, but I just learned the name for it recently. They call it abuelita knowledge. So abuelita is grandma in Spanish. I get so many stories, both in my research and for my students. Oh, my grandma does this, my grandma does that. And it might be, you know, my grandma who lives in a rural village in Mexico, who, you know, didn't get to extend her schooling past the third grade, right? Abuelita has expert knowledge too, right? And so I think kind of being open to looking for expertise in different places. So we have lots of preconceived notions about the climate crisis and the environmental crisis more broadly. And a lot of people think that they know, like, if only people will do this, if only people can think about it this way, then it's going to be solved. And I think it's important to enter into these conversations with openness and learning from different people's perspectives.
What is the most rewarding part about what you do?
I think the most rewarding aspect of my job is really in the classroom and getting to watch my students develop identities as agents of change. So as I've mentioned, they come into the class thinking that they're not environmentalists, and they think that the problems are too big for them to address and that they need experts like me to fix the problems and that they have nothing to contribute. And it's really rewarding to watch that change over the course of the semester as they begin to kind of identify things from their own families, their own values, their own habits that can offer unique outlooks and contributions for addressing the crisis. There's one student in particular who's a religious studies major, and she just happened to take my class on religion and ecology, even though she wasn't really interested in the subject. And through the class, she would have these aha moments like, oh, my dad does that. Yes, my mom does that. You know, and she ended up recalling all of this ecological knowledge that her father had taught her in the garden at his house, and that he had learned that from his grandfather. And, you know, they still, every year her father digs into the dirt and makes an oven, and they cook like they're part of their Christmas dinner in the dirt. And she'd never thought of that as environmentalism before. And then she's embraced this really strong identity as an environmentalist. And then after CSUN, she went on and got her MSW, her master's in social work, and her capstone project was this whole environmental justice project that she was working on environmental justice issues in the neighborhoods. So that was like a, you know, a stellar example, but, you know, it's not always as dramatic as that, but it's nice to see kind of that transition happen. And I hope, you know, that's my goal in my writing as well. I don't get to see that, but my hope is that when people read my work, that they'll have identity shifts as well.
So that concludes our interview. It's been very interesting. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for watching.
And remember to follow us on our Instagram at Concerning Climate Podcast.
And remember to do good things for the environment.
See you soon.
Bye.